This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Mark Klein, has seen something he never thought he would, watching children with HIV live long enough to have children of their own. In addition to treating children in the U.S., Dr. Klein has started pediatric AIDS clinics in Romania and four African countries, Lesotho, Botswana, Malawi, and Swaziland. He's the president of the Baylor International Pediatric AIDS Initiative, which is now partnering with UNICEF and has become the biggest pediatric AIDS initiative in the world. Dr. Klein is also the head of retrovirology at Texas Children's Hospital. How has the prognosis for children with HIV changed?
Here in the United States, there has been a really remarkable change in the outlook for children with HIV with the advent of highly active antiretroviral therapy. These are combinations of antiretroviral drugs that can nearly totally suppress the ability of the virus to replicate within the body. And these therapies became available in the mid-1990s, and subsequently, children with HIV in the United States have lived long and really very healthy lives. But in the developing world, where access to drugs has been limited up until now, children continue to die at a very high rate. About 600,000 children died last year alone of HIV/AIDS globally.
Do most children with HIV get it from their mothers?
Well, they do, yes. Globally, more than 90% of the children with HIV have acquired the virus from their mothers. The virus can be passed across the placenta during pregnancy. It can be passed from mother to infant at the time of delivery because of exposure of the infant to maternal blood and vaginal and cervical secretions. And then it can be transmitted after birth through breastfeeding. And so those really are the three principal time points at which the virus can be transmitted from mother to baby.
And it must be hard in some places to convince mothers not to breastfeed their children.
It can be. In a number of settings around the globe, there really isn't a viable alternative to breastfeeding. Water is not safe for drinking. It often is contaminated. Breastfeeding, of course, is a protection against diarrhea and other potentially life-threatening infections. And formula is prohibitively expensive in very many poor settings around the world. And then in addition, across Africa, there's a certain stigma associated with formula feeding. Mothers are expected to breastfeed. And if the mother is not breastfeeding, the community may conclude that it is because she is HIV positive.
Your interest in international work with children who have HIV started in Romania in the 90s. How did you get there in the first place?
Well, I had been taking care of children with HIV in the United States from about 1987 on, and I had seen the transformation in the health of children with HIV here. And in February of 1996, I made a trip to Romania, and I visited a number of orphanages where there were hundreds of HIV-infected children wasting and dying of AIDS. And it had quite an impact on me. I came back to the United States knowing that I had to do something to help. At that point in my career, I thought I had seen everything. I really thought I knew everything there was to know about pediatric HIV. But I realized at that point that this disease was having a terrible impact on children in the poor countries. And so we started a program at Baylor that initially was focused on training doctors and nurses in Romania how to take care of children with HIV. And it subsequently grew into a care and treatment program for children with HIV in Romania. And from there, we expanded to Africa and to Latin America and then to Asia.
Why were so many children in Romania infected with HIV?
Romania is an interesting place. Fortunately, it's unique. There were thousands of children infected with HIV in Romania in the late 1980s because of certain medical practices that were prevalent at the time, in particular the use and reuse of disposable needles and the injection of unscreened human blood for a variety of reasons, for stimulating the immunity of newborn infants, for promoting growth, for combating iron deficiency anemia and malnutrition. All of this was without any real scientific basis. But thousands of children became infected with the virus. And
a lot of them were infected by doctors who were trying to help them by injecting blood?
Yes. So the epidemic in Romania really is a consequence of medical practices. It is what is termed nosocomial or hospital acquired. And so most of these children actually acquired the infections in the hospitals or in some cases in orphanages. And many of them, at least 6,000 or 7,000, are still alive today. And, of course, as a consequence of time, they're adolescents and young adults.
What did you see on your first trip to Romania? What kind of conditions were the children with AIDS who you saw living in?
Well, the medical conditions of the children were just really stark. The children had open sores on their skin. They had terrible lesions in their mouths. They were wasted. Many of them literally were skin and bones. They had terrible chronic pneumonia and chronic diarrhea. These were the sickest children that I had ever seen in my life, and far more ill than any children with HIV I had ever seen in the United States. And it was so striking to me, I think, because, again, it came at a time when highly active antiretroviral therapy had restored American children to health. And it was such a striking contrast to see these children so ill without access to these life-saving drugs.
Do you still continue to make trips to Romania? And if so, can you tell us the story of one of the children who is maybe not a child anymore, whose story you've continued to follow?
Yeah, I do travel frequently to Romania. I was just there at Christmas time, and it really is remarkable to see the transformation. First, for the population as a whole in Constanza, the city where our center is located, the annual death rate for HIV-infected children dropped in 3 years from 13% per year to less than 1% per year. That's the difference between 109 deaths in a year and only 7 deaths. That obviously was a remarkable change. Children were living instead of dying. We saw a 90% reduction in hospitalizations, so that the pediatric ward at the infectious disease hospital, which in 2001 on any given day had an average of about 34 HIV-infected children hospitalized for various complications, that number dropped to 4 by 2003. But for the children individually, the transformation has been equally remarkable. These little wasted, stunted children, in some cases children who were 10 or 11 or 12 years old but looked like 3- and 4-year-old children, have grown tall and strong. Many of them are taller than I am today. They look perfectly healthy. Some have graduated high school. Many of them are in job training. Some of them are living independently. Many of them have married. We've had about 10 pregnancies and births of children from girls who are cared for in our clinic in the past year. Fortunately, none of the babies are infected. So these children that I think just about everyone thought would lead very short, painful lives and die young are actually living and not just surviving but thriving. And they can look forward to very full lives. And this is a consequence of good medical care and highly active antiretroviral therapy.
What are some of the big differences you've seen in dealing with AIDS in Africa versus dealing with AIDS in Romania?
In Romania, the epidemic was what the epidemiologists sometimes refer to as is almost a closed cohort. It was a group of children who were infected at a particular point in time, and then they aged through infancy and into the school age years and ultimately into adolescence and now are becoming young adults. So even in 1996, when I began working in Romania, most of the children were 6, 7, 8 years old. In Africa, on the other hand, the children have been infected vertically, that is from mother to infant, either during pregnancy or around the time of delivery or through breast milk. And that has been a continuous phenomenon over a period of years now. And most of the children who come to medical attention are rather young. Half are under 2 years of age. And so there are special challenges associated with treating very, very young children, particularly challenges to treating infants, getting the medications into the infants, determining the proper dosages of the medications, making certain that the medicines aren't producing any toxicity in an infant. All of that is a bit more complicated than the treatment of older children. The pace of the disease also in Africa is somewhat different. It's been observed that about half of African children with HIV die without treatment by the age of two, which means that you have really a limited window of opportunity to intervene with treatment. If you haven't identified the infant as being HIV positive and instituted therapy within the first 18 months or 24 months of life, it's very likely that that child will have died.
What are some of the biggest obstacles you've faced in setting up these pediatric AIDS clinics in African countries?
Well, the challenge has been that there really was no blueprint for it. And certainly early on when we got started, authorities and very knowledgeable people were questioning whether the kinds of treatment that were given to HIV-infected people in the United States ever would be practical or affordable for HIV-infected people in Africa and other poor parts of the world. And so it was difficult to overcome that sort of idea that it was futile, that basically people who were infected were just going to die and that there was nothing that could be done.
You know, the more clinics that you set up in Africa while also dealing with the pediatric program in the United States at Texas Children's Hospital, the more overwhelming it must seem. And I guess I'm wondering if it ever gets so overwhelming to see, like, so many children with HIV.
It can be. You know, the key, I think, is not to focus on the enormity of the problem, but on the individual stories and individual successes. And any big problem can be dissected down into a number of smaller, more manageable problems. And this is the way that I try to approach everything that we do. I think one of the reasons that life-saving treatment did not make its way to African children and other children living in the poor countries earlier on was that people just simply threw up their hands in despair. They said the program is too big, there is nothing we can do. But you have to make that first step. You have to start somewhere, and that's what we've done. You put a few dozen children on treatment, and then a few hundred, and a few thousand, you know, it's a life or death difference for those children who you have provided access to treatment. And but it really is a race against time. We have a limited window of opportunity here to roll out treatment to hundreds of thousands of children, to bring to scale treatment programs that to date really have just been established on kind of a pilot basis. And we have to work quickly or we will lose a generation of African children in particular.
Can you tell us about one of the children who you've treated for a long period of time, who you've watched grow up with HIV, and tell us how they've handled it?
Sure. Well, one patient who comes immediately to mind is a little girl who I first saw at about 2 years of age. She had been born to a crack-addicted mother, was infected with HIV at birth.
This was in America?
In America, yes, here in the United States, and was adopted at about 6 months of age by a family who knew her HIV status. She was a sickly infant and toddler. She had been hospitalized repeatedly, had failed to thrive, had repeated bouts of pneumonia and diarrhea. And the doctors who saw her initially had told her adoptive parents that it was unlikely she would survive to school age. But at about 2 years of age, she became one of the first American children to receive highly active antiretroviral therapy, and it had a dramatic effect in restoring her immune system to health. The level of virus in her blood dropped to below levels of detectability. And she literally has been completely healthy for the past 10 years with no detectable virus in her blood during that entire period of time. And over the past 10 years, she's grown into a beautiful young teenager who is a great student, who is an athlete, and who is thriving in every sense of the word. And this is really what we hope for every child with HIV. This is a real possibility. It is not fantasy to think that the children so ill today in Africa and around the world with HIV can be restored to health and can live long and very full lives. We're not talking about the difference between dying at 2 or 3 years of age or dying at 5 years of age. We're talking about the difference between dying at 2 or 3 years of age and living to be 40 or 50 or 60 years old.
Do you feel like you are capable of seeing an end to the AIDS epidemic?
I think we have a long way to go. I don't know realistically that this is something we will see anytime soon. We have to stem the flow of new infections. And that depends at this point in time on behavioral change and on the rollout for children in particular of programs to prevent mother-to-child transmission. And I don't see a great deal of progress on either of those fronts. A vaccine certainly is something a lot of people are working towards, but we may be a number of years away from an effective vaccine for prevention of HIV. So I don't know that it's realistic to think, at least in the foreseeable future, to think about an end to the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
Well, Dr. Klein, thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Mark Klein is the head of the Baylor International Pediatric AIDS Initiative, which is now partnering with UNICEF. He's also a professor of pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine.